Welcome to the Words Matter podcast, enhancing patient care through better communication. Welcome to another episode of the Words Matter podcast. I'm Oliver Thompson. So I hope you've enjoyed the last couple of episodes exploring pseudoscientific claims and how to think about and respond to them. And to give us all a break from the frustration, today I'm speaking with Dr. Rebecca Olson about the role and value of sociology for practice. Rebecca is an Associate Professor of Sociology and Program Director of the Bachelor of Social Science at the University of Queensland, and she's Director of Socio Health Lab, a research collective that pursues social transformation in health and healthcare through theory and justice-led applied social cultural research. And as a translational qualitative researcher, Rebecca collaborates with health professionals, educators, and emotions scholars, bringing sociological insight to addressing complex healthcare challenges. And Rebecca follows in the growing line of guests based at University of Queensland, including Creamy Mosquito, Episode 39, Where Does the Power Lie? A Critical Look at the Biopsychosocial Model, Jenny Setchell in Episode 50 of the Qualitative Research series, What's Left in the Ruins, Post-Qualitative Research, and more recently, Natalia Costa, Episode 68 of the Clinical Reasoning series, Navigating Uncertainty. So in this episode, we speak about the distinction between sociology and social science, and where sociology sits within the landscape of intellectual inquiry. And Rebecca introduces sociology as a research field and how she and others have engaged with it in relation to healthcare. And we talk about medical sociology and the development-related methodologies, such as grander theory and ethnographic research. And we talk about the importance and value of sociological theory for practice. And we talk about how there is nothing like a good theory to offer a rich perspective and multiple lenses on clinical practice. We talk about the difference between the social world and the natural world. And we also talk about what social theories are and where they come from. And we talk about the irony that while social factors and determinants of health seem to be important in understanding and predicting illness and recovery, yet sociological knowledge does not feature strongly in healthcare education or practice. And finally, we talk about what we can learn from sociological inquiry and how it can inform practice and policy. So I love this conversation. As clinicians, we seem to be very happy and comfortable with the other ologies, such as biology, physiology or neurology. So I hope that this conversation is a gateway to explore how sociology can support and guide clinical thinking and practice. So I bring you Dr. Rebecca Olson. Rebecca, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So you're following in the long line of phenomenal UQ guests. I mean, I almost need to have a separate section of the podcast dedicated to UQ faculty and students with Jenny, Karimi, Natalia. So yeah, as I said before, I think to Natalia, it's just this brilliant breeding ground, if that's the right word, probably not the right phrase, but just generating so much interesting research and discussion. So welcome.
Thank you. Yes, we're all part of Socio Health Lab, this really great collective where we come together and doing justice-oriented, theory-driven health research, doing health research differently.
Is it something in the coffee they put in your coffee machines over there? Or what is it that's just making you all so productive and producing such great work?
Oh, coffee, I think it's just a place where we've found a home. We found a whole range of people who are really interested in doing health research this way. Jenny's, of course, been a really central part of that. They're a strong community builder and likes to bring people together in conversation and not just a quick kind of passing hello in the corridor, but let's start something and, you know, let's do it in a way that has a flat structure that really brings everyone to the table and makes them feel invested and interested. So that's been really useful in bringing everyone along in this kind of journey of becoming something as a community, but also becoming in terms of the direction of our research trajectories, all learning from each other how to do it a bit differently.
And at this point, you can introduce yourself, your academic background, what you're currently doing, how you describe what you do.
Sure. So I'm a health sociologist and an emotions sociologist. So I grew up in the US, but then moved to Australia almost 20 years ago to finish my undergrad and do honors and a PhD. And I did that in sociology, but specifically in health sociology. So I had one of my supervisors was a health or medical sociologist. Typically, the US, they call it medical sociology because of that history of sociologists, well, medicine really asking sociologists to collaborate with medicine. So it was really sociology of medicine. But after about the 50s, 60s, getting into the 70s, there was a shift towards kind of expanding the focus, which was what has shifted to that label health sociology. So yeah, I was working across kind of public health and health sociology with my supervisors and focused on cancer caregiving. And then I finished my PhD, I started up a lectureship in public health and then shifted to the University of Queensland about over 7 years ago with an appointment as a health sociologist.
And I think the discussion today is trying to, at least for me to and listeners, to get a better understanding of sociological research, evidence, the sorts of knowledge that is generated from that inquiry and how it might be helpful to healthcare professionals and clinicians. You mentioned, interesting, the medical sociology when the community of medicine asked sociologists for help or to better understand their work. Do you know what initiated that? I mean, what made doctors suddenly become interested in sociology? What were they observing in their work that they took notice of to better understand through sociological inquiry?
Well, I'm trying to think. I could think of a particular study, but I think generally the idea was to get a better understanding of how to apply medical practice to a range of different populations, and also to get a better understanding of patients' experiences, but also of medical training. So I'm thinking of one of the very first medical sociology studies was called Boys in White. It was an ethnography of a medical school down in Kansas that Howard Becker and other Chicago school sociologists conducted. It must have been in the 50s because it was published in the early 60s. And the idea was really to get an understanding of how it is that people go in as these students with ideals of really helping people, changing the world, make a difference, and how they come out perhaps somewhat jaded, perhaps with very different maybe survival ideas about how they're going to survive rather than retaining those same dreams of kind of changing the world and helping people. And that was the key finding of the Boys in White, was that there's just so much content that's packed into such a limited time frame that strategies for survival have to predominate. The students have to learn what their examiners want and prioritize what the people who kind of matter in that space, what they want. And this is what resulted in a huge focus on what's called that hidden curriculum, of course, within health professional education.
It must have been 18 months ago now that I did a qualitative research series, and one of the episodes was on grounded theory with Jane Mills and Melanie Birx, and they mentioned Boys in White by Howard Becker as an example of one of the first not the first ethnography, but the first attempt to do some qualitative work. And I think we use that as an example of how the methods weren't that well described compared to, for example, grander theory and more contemporary qualitative methods, which are pretty detailed in how you collect and conceptualize data. Can you comment on kind of what is that? Was that fair? And do you recall the kind of how Boys and White was kind of done? Was it just a naturalistic ethnography, but very much just observing medical students in their kind of work on their education?
Yeah, it was. There was some detail on some of those methodological decisions around, you know, well, why choose this kind of Kansas medical school? Should we choose a really high ranking, prestigious, elite medical school? No, they wanted to pick something very kind of middle of the road. And it was conducted over several years. So it was there, I think it might have been, and this is pressing me because I haven't read it for over 10 years, but it definitely is a text that stuck with me. But it did have some detail about, you know, just shadowing a lot of the students, going along, observing, watching what it was that they were doing on pracs and within, say, anatomy labs, as well as kind of observing and going alongside with examinations, but also supplemented by interviews. But you're right, I would see that as very much part of what some have described in the kind of post-qualitative inquiry space as qualitative 1.0. This kind of, you know, qualitative research is just something that happens in a black box that nobody really knows how to explain. It's just something that goes on. Mm-hmm. And that was followed by qualitative 2.0, where you see grounded theory. And there's this attempt to be really, really detailed, perhaps overly detailed.
And rigorous.
Very.
Almost a quantitative rigor, yeah.
Yes, yes. And you can really, with Glaser and Strauss, I believe one's a psychologist and one is a sociologist. And both in the US, both of those disciplines have a very strong affiliation with statistical methods. And you can really see that shining through in how they're describing each step, taking that approach to line by line coding. And this idea as well that you could go into research and be able to kind of bracket that comes from phenomenology, could kind of bracket anything that you knew so that you could try and let the findings emerge, which then, of course,
not read the literature.
Don't even read the literature. Just go in totally blind, which maybe was something you could do in the 60s, 70s, maybe 80s, before, of course, we saw such a swell in the number of publications and studies that are coming out all the time. It was perhaps more of a blank slate. And then followed by Qual 3.0, where Charmez, Glaser's own PhD candidate and OT, says, I disagree with you. And we really need to recognize, of course, how central interpretation and the interpreter is to this whole process. And then, of course, others since then critiquing that very rigid approach to grounded theory that was in those first iterations. And now we've got Qual 4.0, post-qualitative inquiry, that's research through theory. So they've kind of gone from the 2.0 era of trying to forget everything you know. You know, this is about making theory from the research and trying to kind of bracket anything you know, to actually theory is part of how we see the world. It's part of how we do our research. It's part of our interpretations. We can't deny it. It's actually the research tool.
I think grounded theory, the early classic grounded theorists were pretty strong on not bringing theory in early at all. But I think later on in the analysis, it was acceptable to use theory as data. I mean, Glaser said all as data. So at some point you could bring in theory to help develop kind of formal substantive theory. But you're right, post-qualitative research, and this is what I spoke with Jenny about and a bit about with Dave Nichols last year, that it's far more purposeful in how it thinks through theory or thinks with theory.
Absolutely. And I agree with the foregrounding of theory that this is why this is a key thing that social theorists, social researchers, critical scholars bring to the research that's valued. Their theoretical training that pushes an understanding of any problem, pushes that understanding from multiple different lenses, that foregrounds certain things, backgrounds others. And I appreciate the kind of boldness of really saying theory should come first, because this is what is absent in a lot of that post-positivist research, this assumption that, theory is separate. Theory is either something that results from the research or, we're not doing a theoretical piece. This is empirical, that the two can be divorced. But of course, it comes in the concept, in the hypothesis, in the research design. It's there.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that quantitative research is just theory-free or value-free, and that it's this kind of reduced down, pure knowledge of the world and is untouched by theoretical assumptions or positioning doesn't make any sense. I mean, even true positivist research has a bunch of assumptions or theoretical assumptions about itself, which it then drives analysis and data collection.
Mm. And the kind of practice, of course, of post-positivism and the Vienna Circle that's really responsible kind of philosophically for progressing discussions from kind of positivism to post-positivism. Of course, in that space, there's a very strong foregrounding of those philosophical assumptions and their underpinnings from really Enlightenment era ways of understanding and theorizing the world. So what ends up happening typically when people say that theory is separate to their research, it's that they're reinforcing what we might say is kind of maybe 1600s, 1700s style European philosophy theory without acknowledging it.
Yeah. I'm conscious we've just launched into a whole range of discussions, and I guess I want to just take it a few steps back and think about sociology and just to try and understand what that's all about. And when you're at a dinner party, if people still have dinner parties or some social event, and people say, "What do you do?" And you say, "I'm a sociologist," and they either just nod in agreement, not really knowing what you do. But what's sociology about, and how do you describe what it is, and how should we think about sociology? And maybe just distinguish it from social science. The terms are used interchangeably. I know I sometimes kind of interchange them, and it's not correct that they are quite different.
Well, usually if I'm introducing and I say, "Oh, yes, I'm an associate professor in sociology," and they'll say, "Oh, is that like psychology? Is that the same as psychology?" So that's the typical kind of first question. But in short, sociology is the kind of systematic study of society, of groups of people who make meaningful patterns that form institutions and social structures that shape how they see the world, how they see themselves, how they see each other, and continue to make and remake meaningful patterns of social existence. How is it different to social science? It's one of many social sciences. I think in terms of medical sociology, our kind of closest neighbors are probably medical anthropologists who might emphasize culture a bit more within their focus, whereas sociologists are focusing perhaps more often on that meaningful kind of social interactions. And anthropologists also like to center the environment, a kind of ecological approach that looks at health and illness as very much dynamic in terms of cultures, meanings, and environmental framings. In the social sciences more broadly, we might include psychology, geography, economics, as well as anthropology, criminology, sociology, political science, international relations. There are a whole range of different theories. And in many ways, we share probably a strong interest in similar methods across, with psychology and sociology, as I said before, having strong reputations in very rigorous and advanced kind of quantitative research. but also with anthropology and sociology, having that strong foundation in ethnographic interview and a range of different qualitative methods.
So in terms of the sociology and its use of research methods, it's kind of agnostic as regards to what sort of method to use. I mean, you can be a sociologist conducting large-scale cross-sectional surveys about people's beliefs or attitudes or whatever it might be, but also do some smaller qualitative in-depth studies using interviews or observations. So it kind of draws upon a range of techniques or methods.
Oh, absolutely. Sociology as itself, sociology itself is very much diverse in its research tools and also, yeah, very diverse in those theoretical tools as well. Sociologists as individuals are not agnostic in our research methods and theoretical tools. We tend to favor particular tools. And although, you know, we all have training in quantitative and qualitative, we tend to, you know, end to gravitate towards one. There are some who really are well-versed in a range of methods and can really easily shift from one side to the other. And projects tend to be diverse in that way. At least the projects that I work on, I collaborate with other sociologists, I collaborate with clinicians, and they tend to always be mixed methods. And this is kind of aligned with that approach that I think I mentioned before, the post-paradigmatic approach in particular that I've used in looking at emotions and studying social emotions, and how using a range of different paradigms or kind of research traditions from these more quantitative kind of physiological approaches through to those interactionist ones like interviews, as well as participatory approaches where we get participants to be reflexive on the data that we've collected, that can really help us not only to study emotions in a range of different ways, but foreground those different ways of conceptualizing and theorizing emotions. And it helps us to kind of put those different framings together.
And I think when I use the example, sociologists looking at attitudes and beliefs, I sense a reaction in you that maybe that wasn't sociology, or maybe that's, I suppose what I'm trying to say is that when is one not doing sociology and when is one doing sociology? So for example, what are the boundaries? So for example, let's say looking at attitudes, beliefs, or how these beliefs are constructed, or perceptions or group perceptions. I mean, that seems to smell and taste a bit like sociology, but it might be theory free and you may not engage in theory. Likewise, you can have a theory rich, clearly sociological project. I mean, when are there any defining features when you're doing sociology, or actually you can point to something and say that's not sociological research, even though it's got a title that would appear so?
Well, I think it was John Uri, I'm not sure if I'm saying his name correctly, but he famously, at least in my mind, described sociology as a usurpationary discipline. So a usurpationary discipline. It just likes to usurp things from other disciplines that we find interesting and say, oh, okay, now that's part of sociology. Thank you. and bring it into our sandbox to kind of play with.
Like a magpie.
Yeah. In terms of attitudes, beliefs, and perceptions, that might be this kind of crossover space, social psychology. I would see that as really in that space where you might be looking at individuals, but individuals perhaps within a small group setting or just in a kind of dyad. And it might be sociological, but if it's kind of primarily drawing understandings of attitudes and beliefs and perceptions from that psychological tradition, then that might distinguish it. Sociology, what enables us to kind of identify something as sociological is typically when it has a strong engagement with theory that's employed in sociology. So whether that theory comes from social philosophy, anthropology, even a historical space, if it's brought in conversation with other sociological theory or is making a kind of claim on how it is that the social world works and not just how the social world perhaps affects individuals solely, then it's sociological. Because I'm thinking of epidemiology, right? epidemiology, there is a lot of crossover, especially in medical sociology. Things like the social determinants of health, they're very focused on how social world inequality, hierarchies can have an influence statistically on the likelihood of a person's, you know, a person developing cardiovascular disease, a person having a life expectancy of a certain number, depending on what neighborhood they live in currently or grew up in when they're younger. But it would be epidemiological unless it's asking those questions of why is that the case? How do we understand these kinds of how these social structures perpetuate those inequalities? If it's purely kind of, it's just data that's served and said, here, this is what we found, life expectancy, but not asking those questions of why, then it's not shifting. There's always that critical question of who benefits that's very core to a critical sociological tradition.
And I guess it's, you know, that's a great example that epidemiology could potentially, and I'm going to paraphrase you and get you wrong as well at the same time, that it can sit in both camps. You can maybe frame an epidemiological study depending on how you use theory, the sorts of questions you're asking, or that data is serving. I suppose it demonstrates to me the kind of interaction. I mean, I'm thinking the biopsychosocial model, for example, when we try to neatly define kind of biological factors or determinants with social, with psychological. And the kind of truth is it's just one big jelly blob of co-interacting variables or domains. And the epidemiological example is a good one that clearly the social determinants will influence or be interacting with the biological determinants or the medical determinants. And it just becomes a much more complex situation.
Absolutely. And this is a kind of key focus within some of the medical sociology scholarship as well, where some have been quite critical of some of that research by Marmot and others who focus on kind of stress and status. And by focusing on stress, they argue that it actually takes the kind of critical edge away from the kind of potential of these findings. We accept that hierarchies and stress are inevitable, whereas some of those more Marxist-oriented medical sociologists say, if we bring in a focus on economics and Marx's concept of the economic superstructure, it pushes us to ask, how could it be otherwise? It pushes us to examine how our economic structures are dismantling of the social welfare state may be influencing these epidemiological outcomes. Whereas if we focus on stress, our tendency might be to think about yoga interventions and more kind of individual lifestyle interventions rather than addressing even what Marmot himself calls the causes of the cause.
And there are two questions which I'm just asking for my own curiosity, because I'm not quite sure about them. One is earlier you mentioned the social world, and I kind of use that phrase and that kind of term is going to utilize throughout the literature. And I thought I knew what it meant when I was writing my PhD, but I'm not quite sure. I think I just put it in there because it sounded like when you're making inquiry around the social world, there's a certain set of rules, a set of assumptions and a kind of paradigms that kind of conform to the social world. And then there's the natural world, which I guess is observing leopards or mitochondria. And that's got I suppose, why are we making the distinction between the natural world and the social world? And when you're doing medicine, for example, you're looking at red blood cells under a microscope, but also there's a person or a group of people which we're calling patients. And that seems to be in the social world. So that kind of separation seems artificial, but understandable.
And a lot of social constructionists see, you know, drawing on Wittgenstein, these categories as socially constructed. That a lot of what we see, that we take for granted as absolute truths, they're based on how it is that we've grouped things together as social actors. We've seen this constellation of things as aligned in some way. So we've put them in this category. And that's a really core focus. Kind of labeling is a core focus of, in particular, sociology of mental health, but also of a whole range of health problems where we've seen very real impacts. When you give a label to something, it lends medical authority to that categorical label, like chronic fatigue syndrome, ADHD. These titles have been a very big focus of research into medicalization because these labels matter. Once you label something, Thomas and Thomas, husband and wife, early sociologists from about 100 years ago, I'll paraphrase it in a non-gendered way, that which we perceive to be real is real in its consequences. When we see these categories as real things, we respond to them accordingly, and that has flow-on kind of social effects. But in terms of what's part of the social world and part of, you know, the kind of natural world, there's been a long history of drawing on kind of the natural world to inform the social world as well. Not only is the social world kind of shaping how we understand the natural world, but it goes vice versa, where there's a long history of people saying, oh, well, you know, this is how things happen in nature. It's in terms of reinforcing kind of gendered expectations. And then, of course, you know, we bring up seahorses and penguins, emperor penguins, to say, no, that is not, it's not exclusively gendered in this way in the natural world. So it's also probably the case that that social lens comes into what people observe within the natural world as well.
Is it the case, I mean, coming back to kind of healthcare practice, that's a sociological situation or phenomenon, but there are red blood cells and they float around and there's sometimes things happen to those and these are clearly biological, I want to say objective phenomena. They're essentially going to behave whether or not we're looking at them. I don't know, the double slit thing. I can't talk about the electron, but forget about that for the moment. But I get, you know, maybe we've hit bedrock here, but clinical practice would seem to be largely sociological, but borrowing on natural, biological. I'm conflating the two.
Well, it reminds me of Anne-Marie Mole's concept of multiplicity in studying atherosclerosis, that there's a constellation of a range of different signs that indicate a particular diagnosis, but they all hang together on one social being. They're all, you know, enacted by a social actor in a social interaction. So there might be also a range of more kind of biological or biomedical presentations, but they're coming together in one social actor.
It brings me back, or makes me think about a previous podcast conversation with Peter Stilwell and Sabrina Konings, and we spoke about inactivism and how that kind of binds biological with social with psychological, because they're not straightforward to connect, given some of the underpinning assumptions around them.
And our desire to kind of put things in neat and discrete categories. We tend to prefer the heuristic ease of engaging in distinct baskets rather than seeing things as, you know, interacting in a stew. And teaching with my OT colleague, Tim Bartlett, he likes to bring up John Dewey's work, that understanding of transactionalism and understanding how the, you know, person and environment and their relationship, it's not, you know, person and environment as two separate categories, but instead they are like vegetables in a stew. Give them a little bit of time and they become almost indistinguishable, part of the same messy, sometimes gelatinous, mushy mix.
And the other question or thought that I had was around theory, and we've spoken about theory quite a lot in the podcast, and what it means, how it's used, but also where they come from. So I guess things like, I don't know, I'm thinking of sociological theory, symbolic interactionism, or kind of Parsons' sick role, these kind of reasonably big, well-known theories, where do they come from? Is it just, I don't know, Bloomer or Parsons sitting in a room thinking up these things and then they're just consumed by little sociologists kind of take the stuff up? Is it based on empirical study? And where do theories come from and why are they so important? And arguably, from maybe post-qual, points of view that they're almost more important than some of the data, or there is no data without the theory.
Yes, that era of kind of armchair theorizing had quite a presence in the 20th century. But yeah, as we got kind of towards the latter half, there was much more of an emphasis on empirical data, but also on that need to kind of bring theory and empirical data together. And certainly with grounded theory, to have empirical data drive at least meso theory development. Can you go back again to what the question was, Oliver? Sorry.
It was kind of where do theories come from? So I get with grounded theory, they kind of generate these kind of, I don't know, first level, low level, almost micro theories, potentially, or bigger kind of formal theories. But they're kind of bigger sociological theories, of which I only know about three. Where do they come from? And why is it that we should care about them? Is it that they're proven to be kind of true, in air quotes, or effective? Or do they just work from a pragmatic point of view? They just seem to give us some kind of sense of the world. Why do they deserve to be considered? Or how do we make... And it's a very broad question. I get that theories will range from, you know, small, empirically based, to much broader general theories. But and what are these theories, and like, where do we find them?
Where do they come from? Yes. Fernando de Mayo has written about theory in medical sociology. And I use a chapter by him in my health sociology course. And he talks about theories just as really different lenses. So I put, you know, just a picture of glasses up on the PowerPoint slide when I start the lecture on sociological theories that are used in health sociology. And they really come from all over the place, inside sociology, outside sociology. Some are based on armchair theorizing. Some are based on a person's life work. Some are based on one study, and it's just really taken off and inspired a whole range of other scholars to pick it up, expand it, grow it. So I'm thinking of Marx, of course, who's not a sociologist. He was writing before sociology was really a thing. It wasn't until Durkheim that we had our first kind of professor of sociology. But Marx, of course, is central in pushing us to attend to economics, the economic superstructure, and how this is, in his mind, the kind of primary social structure really underpinning conflict and the organization of social life. Then you have people like Bourdieu, who is a kind of anthropologist-sociologist hybrid, who worked throughout his whole career to try and understand the structure-agency divide and resolve the structure-agency divide within the social sciences. How it is that we can be agentic beings and, you know, feel very autonomous, but at the same time be socially determined by these structures, and how these two come together really in a concept he called habitus. How, you know, you have habits. These habits are developed. But they're more than that. These are habits that are connected to your location in an evolving social plane that's related to a whole range, you know, your taste in music, through to your education, through to your embodiment of sport. This is all habitus, and trying to kind of collapse that structure and agency debate within sociology and the social sciences more broadly. So, in short, theories are really just lenses for helping us to foreground some things in our understanding of a social problem and background others. And bringing in multiple lenses can help us to question that initial way of seeing it, disrupt that, and have a rigorous kind of debate, perhaps with our empirical data, with the problem we're trying to solve, about how else we might view it, conceptualizing it, and what problem that pushes us to foreground, and what solution that pushes us to propose.
So given the power, if you like, of theory to kind of shade the world or the social world, which can inform in all sorts of things, the sorts of clinicians we might choose to be, the sorts of relationships we develop with patients. I mean, it would seem to colour potentially every aspect of our clinical lives as healthcare professionals. What's your sense of how theories come into healthcare education? And this is clearly a loaded question, because I had none of it as a student. And And so I was thinking, I'm thinking about how did I see clinical practice? What pair of glasses did I have? And what glasses do kind of graduates have of OT or physical therapy or osteopathy, whatever it might be, given that theory, or at least social theory, wasn't explicitly taught? So I'm kind of seeing the clinical world through the kind of stuff, I mean, the osteopathic kind of dogma and theory, I suppose. I guess I was taught theory, but in a very local sense, in a very, very kind of focus, single pair of glasses. I mean, but it would seem to me that having a range of theories to draw upon would give you a view on the clinical world, which would just be useful and helpful and be able to kind of really utilize these different perspectives.
And that's exactly Rudman's argument for occupational science and occupational therapy. Rudman talks about the need for an occupational imagination, drawing on the early sociologist C. Wright Mills's concept of sociological imagination and how theory acts like a prism that helps you to see the world, the social world, through a different shade, whichever way you tilt it. So yeah, Rudman's arguing that that's what occupational therapy and occupational science needs to really push it to become more of a justice-oriented profession, as well as more of a theoretically rigorous profession, or professions, if you see them as distinct. But certainly, so I did a systematic review of scholarship on interprofessional education in allied health. So that came out seven plus years ago in medical education. And that was one of my key findings, was that theory was largely absent. There were only a few studies that used any theory within the papers reviewed. And that's problematic pedagogically, but also in terms of addressing the power dynamics that are inherent when you bring different professions together. Also, like you're saying about osteopathy and like midwifery, I have an HDR candidate who I'm supervising at the moment, and it's a kind of hybrid midwifery sociology PhD. Definitely in that space, there's a feminist kind of ethic of care that's central to midwifery practice, that's strategically and it's positioned in a kind of social advocacy way to be counter to a more kind of medical dominance presence, and that more, yeah, the I'll call it the feigned objectivity of biomedicine, that idea that biomedicine is objective, it is value neutral, when actually it's reinforcing a kind of Eurocentric kind of 1600s, 1700s view of what it means to be an individual and an entity. And that certainly when it comes to, you know, emotions, that's what a lot of the scholarship shows, that medical education tends to reinforce that kind of mind-body dualist way of seeing things. Despite, of course, so much research within and outside of medicine countering that.
And so why aren't these healthcare courses just pumped full of theory? And why are we just not having, I'm sure if you looked at the breakdown of kind of lectures or learning in most healthcare courses, it would be hugely biased to the medical sciences, anatomy, physiology, a particular type of psychology perhaps, technical skills. And given, and we were talking about this offline, given the important role that social determinants of health and kind of social domains and social factors have on people's recovery, illness, development of pain and all that stuff, it just seems obvious that I'm not saying just knowing a bunch of theories will just make us more effective, but I'm half saying that if we've got a better grasp of the kind of sociological landscape, that's clearly going to be, I would presume, clearly going to be beneficial to the patients, the people that we care for.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. and certainly...
I'm saying, no, I completely disagree. Less sociology.
No. Well, and of course, for one reason, the curriculum is just packed. It's hard to find space for adding anything in. You know, students want a degree that's as quick as it can be. They want to get out there and start practicing. And accreditation bodies don't require it, other than in Australia, occupational therapy, where sociology is required as part of the kind of content. And in teaching some of the OTs, what we find is that it's a bitter but valued pill. The experience has been that it's kind of engaging in some of that, to some extent, a pedagogy of discomfort. We're foregrounding things like privilege. We're foregrounding content that students have not really been practicing, ways of thinking that students feel very unaccomplished in, right? Like, it reminds me of how awful it felt to be a very beginner jujitsu student after doing dance for, you know, 25 years, where I felt very, you know, I felt very confident in dance. I'd been teaching dance. And then I go into this other kind of athletic pursuit, and I was very clearly at the bottom. It's hard to be the novice. It's difficult, but also with sociology comes that focus on justice and foregrounding privilege that can be uncomfortable for those, especially for those who are privileged. And we do know, of course, that especially with books like Doctor's Order by Tanya Jenkins, that really explicates just how elitist some health professional education kind of tracks can be, despite it really having this kind of ideology of being a meritocracy. Of course, the whole system is very geared towards reinforcing privilege. So that can be uncomfortable when we're engaging with theory that pushes us to kind of be reflexive on that. But yeah, what we found in the occupational therapy teaching is that with my colleagues, Meryl Turpin and Tim Bartlett, OTs, students in their feedback at the end of semester say things like, this was really hard. This semester was really, really difficult, but it has changed the way I see everything. So it can be for those who really, yeah, jump in and feel like they're okay with first trying to understand all these different theories that we're throwing at them, playing with them, applying them, and then applying that to their own lives, they find it very worthwhile.
Yeah. And flooding the curriculum with sociological theories is one way about addressing, at least to my understanding, the kind of deficit in sociological skills or at least in musculoskeletal care, which is, I suppose, my area, where historically we're so interested in bits of people and, oh, you've got knee pain and I'll just, you know, look at the knee and maybe have a chat about, you know, what you're doing on the weekend and, you know, how your cat is. That's the kind of social concern I have. That's not fair. I think there's a real drive towards being better at the social stuff or the kind of sociological aspects of someone's illness and suffering, and but they're really hard. I mean, I was thinking about my own practice, and last week or a couple of weeks ago, I had a patient that had a really difficult social circumstances, economic abuse, I mean, all sorts of stuff, which I was just totally ill-equipped to really help this patient in a meaningful way. And that wasn't necessarily because of a lack of sociological knowledge, which I don't have as well, but it was more so kind of social work type skills and how to begin to understand these deeply complex, deep-rooted problems and situations that people are in. So I guess it's social theory with a kind of more abstract stuff, which might inform some of the, I suppose, the social skills or sociological or social working type skills, which we need.
Absolutely. And it applies that example I was talking about before in terms of the social determinants of health that can kind of form a checklist in a person's mind, perhaps when they're in a clinical interaction going like, oh, you know, I need to look out for these certain things. But then, oh, what do I do with it after I've identified that there are these social markers that I need to look out for, or, you know, potential variables that are associated with an increased risk of X. But it's so much more than that. And it's about understanding how to see and work with people who are different to us. And theory can really help take that multi-stakeholder position to understand the layers of interactions and influence on an individual's life. It's not just about clinicians and clients, though, or patients. It's also about clinicians and clinicians. These sociological theories, for example, this tool that I've worked in an interprofessional team to develop called the Video Observational Tool for Interprofessional Skills, VOTIS. That's very much, in terms of interprofessional education, a tool informed by sociological thinking. How is power evident, engaged with, and transcended within interprofessional team decision-making? How are emotions also foregrounded, attended to, and brought to be made useful, not just kind of pushed to the side as something extra or for after teamwork exists, but central to what it means to be human and relational beings?
And yeah, I think you hit the sociological nail on the head is that, and I think what comes through is some of the research looking at clinicians kind of used to the biopsychosocial model and attending to social factors is very much that they might notice some of these social determinants or these social aspects of someone's life, but kind of thinking, well, what do I do with it? I mean, it's bereavement, that's not my bag, like I'm not skilled in it, or it's, you know, the person's homeless or about to be homeless. How can I possibly affect that?
And that's scary if you don't know what to do in that space.
I'm certainly scared the other week, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So I did a study with some palliative care doctors a couple of years ago, and it was very much about that space. So we did interviews with junior clinicians through to really experienced palliative care consultants. And much of the kind of preparation is very guidelines-based, kind of saying we need to be very open, very honest, frank about a person's life-limiting prognosis. And, you know, make sure that understanding occurs, that there's clarity. And yeah, that sounds quite noble, especially in light of the research from Glaser and Strauss about closed and open awareness of dying from California in the 60s, which is where grounded theory kind of got its start from, that ethnographic research that they conducted. But this, of course, is contrary to cultural considerations. It conflicts with kind of culturally safe practices in end-of-life care. We can't have blanket protocols for open awareness when that is contrary to patients and families' wishes for, you know, what they want at the end of life. So yeah, what we'd found was that the junior clinicians were the ones who were more likely to say, yes, you must always be open, always. And it was the more experienced and senior clinicians who had to learn from experience in these scary spaces on how to recognize, how to navigate with family this very tricky interactional terrain. What words do they clue into to judge whether that family is preferring open or closed awareness? What kinds of symbols, when you're working with patients and their families, when you're working with a patient who is deaf, how do you communicate and perceive those clues in a space where you have to perhaps use a translator to speak, or where they close off communication by closing their eyes? I agree, Oliver, and that this kind of really challenging terrain, the relational and the social aspects of care, it tends to be something that is learned perhaps conceptually, but I don't even think it progresses to procedural or dispositional until perhaps people become far more experienced in their jobs. They have to kind of learn it on the go, where I think we should be preparing students more readily for how to do things like handle distress, end-of-life care conversations, how to work with clients who have experienced layers and layers of trauma.
And I guess with that, what advice might you have for listeners, clinicians listening that want to take a more sociological approach to their practice, or at least begin to engage in area. Are there any, because it would seem like a mountainous field of theories and literature and kind of scary. What would be an easy way in to begin to introduce some of these, this way of thinking to clinicians who otherwise may not be aware of it?
That's a tricky one, Oliver. there are quite a range of...
Listen to this podcast, of course, is the first way in and go through the entire...
Yeah, well, listen to all of Oliver's podcasts. Well, actually podcasts are a really great way of engaging, but I think the learning really needs to be stepped. So, you know, starting with some of those really primary textbooks saying introduction to sociology, introduction to health sociology, what is medical sociology, kind of starting there and really get that scaffolding together so that you can have a toolbox of theories at your disposal. But I think it needs to go beyond that, because I think this is kind of perhaps where sociology is more of an applied kind of research discipline, but not an applied practice. I would see that more as kind of the psychology and social work terrain. But this might be where there's a need for greater attention to theory, but also human aspects of care for others and care for oneself, because the two have to go hand in hand within clinical education at an undergraduate university level, but also a continuing education level, and a kind of perhaps a rejection of that old dogs, new tricks saying that...
Oh, it's outside of my scope. I'm not a social worker. It's not my field.
But also like, oh, this is how I've been doing it forever. It's too late for me to kind of re-examine or learn anything or change. It is amazing what some of these techniques like video reflexive ethnography can offer in seeing oneself, you know, videoed in practice, hearing and seeing myself identify certain elements, hearing others identify other things that can prompt me to think differently about what I'm doing, provide feedback that pushes me outside of that habituated way of doing and being. And there can be, I think it might be about creating a safe environment to engage in theories and reflection on practice to really catalyze the value of theory to practice.
Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, visit www.wordsmatter-education.com for all the show notes, resources, and blogs, and check out the online course in language and communication in relation to back pain. And I'll see you next time.